This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl, where this week we covered so much ground, so much so that I reckon you will listen to this episode and someone in your life will pop up, whether you've had a conversation about these topics, whether you think it relates to that person. We talk about goosebumps, babies feeling heavier, flies seemingly flying in a certain formation, and pigs orgasming. There's a lot to tap into. Plus, Valentine's Day is a couple of days away, so we get into some love, sex, and relationships questions with Dr. Carl. I'm Lucy Smith. Let's do this. We are currently in the studio with Dr. Carl because it is a Thursday. Carl, how are you doing?
I am here. I am following the rule. If it's Thursday, I'm here. Yeah. It's as simple as that. I don't have to do any thinking. Love it.
You absolutely are, I guess, strapped to this place every Thursday, answering people's questions. But what's something that you've learnt this week?
I made a mistake last week when I was talking about hydrazine.
Okay. So what was the question first?
It's to do with Starlink satellites and stuff coming back to Earth, and why you should not touch random space stuff that has come down.
That's right. We're talking about that. Yeah. If a random space junk happened to ever come into your midst, don't touch it.
Don't touch it. Almost certainly it's going to be a bit of Starlink because of the 12,000 satellites in orbit that are working, 10,000 are Starlinks, and they have a 5-year lifespan. So that's probably what we're going to see. And they're safe to touch, providing it's not hot. So you're looking at something that starts off the size of a flatbed truck, 9 metres by 2 metres by 20 centimetres thick, weighing a third of a ton. And the way they navigate in space is they get electricity from solar panels. They then put that into a battery. They then get some individual atoms of the gas called krypton and then strip or add electrons to it, so now it's got an electrical charge, and they give the opposite electrical charge to some plates and they squirt it out. So it's basically a rocket. They just squirt out ions of krypton. They do not have hydrazine. There would be some that have hydrazine, but that's a minority. Hydrazine has the advantage of being a monopropellant. So we've had cases where the Voyager spacecraft launched in 1977, that's 40-something years ago.
Wow.
They had a problem with their manoeuvring rockets way out past the edge of the solar system. And after 47 years or whatever, they decided, this rocket has gone, let's try this other hydrazine thing. And it worked after 45 years plus. Anyway, so I was wrong when I said that the Starlinks run on hydrazine. They have electrical propulsion.
Does that feel better having...
Oh my God, I got off my chest. I made a mistake and I'm so glad I had a chance to fix it. Thank you.
If you're just joining us and you're wondering what the hell Dr. Carl is talking about, you can listen back to last week's episode wherever you get your podcast. But let's get into a fresh set of questions. Victoria in Broken Hill kicking us off. Victoria, what's going on?
Good morning, doctors. I've just been wondering, when you get a cold and your nose is just dripping like a tap, is all the snot sort of stored in your sinuses and coming out, or is your body manufacturing it that quickly?
Overwhelmingly, it's manufacturing it that quickly. So think about your blood vessels, 100,000 kilometres of blood vessels in your skin and lots in your nose. In your nose, you have erectile tissue, which also appears in the penis and the clitoris, but not in the same person, obviously. And this erectile tissue can swell and contract. And when it swells, it changes the path of the air. So the dirt has, so the air has to do a sudden change of direction and it throws the dirt off. So the you can notice that you smell more from one nostril than the other, and it changes in depending on who you are every half hour to hour and a half. So just sort of notice which nostril you're smelling out of. In the sweat glands associated with the erectile tissue, in the sweat glands around there, blood comes in and blood goes out minus something. And when you've got your mucus producing glands, they have gone from 0.5% production to full on. And they can generate, I'm kind of, what would you reckon, Victoria? I'm guessing maybe 0.5 mil a minute, maybe a mil a minute, if, you know, when it's really running. Do you get that?
I have no idea, because that was another question, like, how much do we produce? Because when you're blowing your nose like that and going through a box of tissues, it feels like you're just blowing gallons.
Yeah, okay, the way to do it is to weigh it.
Litres.
So the basic principle is this, that on a 24-hour day, your body shifts 40,000 litres of water across the membranes in your body, and it brings it all back again. And you only need a slight imbalance, which is what is happening in the mucus-producing glands in your nose. I'm guessing maybe 0.25 mL/min. The way to tell, weigh the tissues beforehand, weigh them afterwards. 1 gram is 1 mL.
Will you remember to do that, Victoria?
I'm doing that next time I have a cold, and I'll let you know.
Okay, you could win the Triple J Fun Pack. You're up for it, Dr. Victoria.
Thanks, okay. Victoria.
Thank you.
We've got Rhiannon in Eden. Rhiannon, so let's talk flies. You've noticed something when they get into your house.
Yes. Hi, doctors. My name is Rhiannon and I'm from Eden. And my question is why, when a fly sneaks into the house, do they fly around in a square in the exact same spot in the lounge room?
Right. So is this for you sitting down and you see it going in a square, or is it looking from the side of the room or from outside the room? How do you know it's a square, roughly?
So when I'm sitting on the lounge, they are in front of me between me and the TV and they fly around in a square.
Okay, it's unusual, but they're probably following, you know, some sort of scent trail, which is the most obvious thing, or they could be creating something, be following air currents, which I don't think you'd be getting a lot of from the TV because they don't generate that much heat nowadays. I definitely do not know. Normally they'll do it with regard to food, but hopefully if you don't have kids, you've almost certainly not got food lying around in the lounge room. And you're saying, is this a thing that they've been doing over a period of weeks or months or years?
Yeah, just like the last, well, this summer I've noticed really, like you'll get one in and it will leave and then another one will come in a few days after and they always go to the same spot in the same square.
Okay. This is where we do the call out for the entomologist, the insect scientist. Please ring in on something, something, some 757555. What's the first three digits? 0439?
Yes!
0439 757, which is a very powerful passenger jet. 555, which is JJJ on the keypad, if you've got letters on your keypad.
This also, Rhiannon, we'll see what we can do, okay?
Yes.
Awesome. That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Rhiannon.
Dr. Carl, you've also just done something which I think answers another question that we get a lot on the Science Hour. People always text in and say, how does Dr. Carl have such a good memory? How does he remember so much stuff? And it's because you come up with techniques to remember things. So the 757 of the jet that you mentioned, 555 on the triple of the
JJJ, you know, on the
keypad for a telephone. Yeah. So now you just need to have something for the 0439. But that is literally in action how Dr. Carl remembers information. He uses almost like an association of things.
Yeah, and if you use those numbers to win the Powerball tonight, please send a small donation to Triple J so we can have a little party.
So we can have a little piece of the pie. We've got Cindy in Townsville.
Dr. Cindy.
Cindy, what's your question?
Good morning, doctors. How are you going?
Pitchy keen, Dr. Cindy.
My question is, I've noticed when I'm rocking, I've got a 2-year-old and an 8-week-old, when I rock them to sleep, when they actually fall asleep, they feel a lot heavier. Why is that?
No idea, and I've noticed that it's real. It is definitely real, and every parent, and I've spoken to a few parents about it, you know, they're holding a baby, I say, oh, how's your baby? Nice, nice, nice. And then I'll throw in does your baby feel heavier when it goes to sleep? I say, yeah. The baby is the same weight.
Exactly.
And you're using the same arms to hold it. The only thing I can think of is that the baby goes from rigid to floppy, but I do not understand how that makes the baby feel heavier. And what we need is a physiologist to ring in on 0439 757 555.
Yes.
It is definitely real, Dr. Cindy. And I have not been able to get an answer because I've been lazy and I haven't asked an exercise physiologist. They probably know.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Then maybe the tensing of the body and then the...
And they go floppy. Yeah. But they weigh the same.
That's what keeps getting me stuck. I'm like, they still weigh the same.
But when they go floppy...
Okay, yeah, they're still the same child.
Yeah, they're still the same. And the thing is that instead of you just holding their legs and their upper body is away from your upper body, they just collapse and their upper body falls onto your chest and shoulders. Why should that make any difference? I don't know. The second I don't know in a row. Square flies and heavy babies.
Cindy, let's see what we can do.
Yes,
awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, we've got Alice in Murrumbina who is texting in about the flies, saying, yes, oh my God, flies do that all the time at our house. A Pippa, you said flies definitely do. We even call them box flies at home for that exact reason. And someone else saying, I believe the flies are doing a territory flight. They fly around in a rough square to claim territory. If you have a couple flying around together, you can actually see them bump into each other and fight. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty certain.
By industry, they call this ground int, as in ground intelligence. So we've got people saying, I have seen this also.
All right.
Wow.
Let's see if we can get an expert. We've got Isabel who's texted in saying, I'm an RN. The reason why toddlers feel heavy is because of their head. We often forget how heavy their heads are, and when they're being held, they're supporting their own weight and it's dispersing evenly across the body. When they're asleep, their head flops and you feel more of the weight because it's not evenly dispersed across the body.
So you're feeling the head as a separate thing. Okay, so your sensation of carrying something is not just simply what's happening in your hands, but your hands and on your body as well.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, thank you very much, Dr. Isabel. I hadn't thought of that. Thank you.
Send in your questions on 0439 757 555, just like Pete in Adelaide did. Dr. Pete, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. I have a question about cataracts. I wondered, can you tell me what they actually are, how they're formed, and can they be prevented?
Mm.
So, cataracts are part of... Okay, back off. You've got two eyeballs. At the front, you've got a kind of a lens called the cornea, and it's fairly powerful. You measure it in diopters, it's about 40 diopters. And then you've got the lens, which is adjustable, and it's another lens. So the lens is a lens, the cornea is a lens. It's kind of globular, like a ball, and there are muscles on the side that can make it change shape from more globular to less globular. And when you're very young, say 2 or 3, you can adjust from, say, 2 to 18 diopters, and by the time you're 40 is about 2 or 3 diopters adjustment, so you're kind of stuck with, you've either got distance vision or close vision, but not both. There's a whole bunch of cells in there, and the cells keep on getting laid down, and occasionally the proteins, but not in everybody, occasionally the proteins will begin to denature and break down and become opaque. So they're totally transparent, but then you get the proteins in there. And then they discovered during the Second World War a cure for it. So what was happening in the Second World War, you had pilots flying around in the fighter planes, single engine, firing bullets at each other. And occasionally they'd get hit, and they had a cover over the plane made of perspex. And occasionally bullets would hit and bits of perspex would go into their body and occasionally into their eye. Now, here's a weird thing. Anything that goes into your eye normally sets off an immune reaction like crazy, but in the Second World War, it was discovered that bits of perspex in the eye did not set off this reaction. They did not set off the immune reaction, the inflammation. And so the procedure was made that where you would come into the side of the eyeball, cut it, take out the opacified lens, known as a cataract, and replace it with a bit of perspex.
Oh.
And that was discovered from the Second World War. And so this was in America, it costs many thousands of dollars, ten thousands of dollars. Fred Hollows, who was Australian of the Year, did it for $400. And he actually taught people in third world countries how to do this operation in 15 minutes. And so you'd have people specifically trained for this one operation, and they'd ride off on their motorbike and they had the little sets of kits and they'd put the green stuff over your eye, give you the anaesthetic, there'd be a green sheet with a hole in it, and they'd just a person who'd been trained maybe for 2 weeks in this one specific job, they would remove the opacified lens and replace it with a bit of perspex. 20 million people suffer from it. The way to reduce the chances of it happening are to wear sunglasses that block ultraviolet light and a broad-brimmed hat and avoid diabetes and, you know, the boring stuff of keep healthy.
All the boring stuff.
All the boring stuff. Yeah, do exercise, keep healthy, boring.
Thanks, Pete.
Dr. Carl, that was a wonderful resource. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, we've got Patrick in Canberra. Dr. Patrick, you've been experiencing something for the first time recently. Talk us through it.
Good morning, doctors. Yes, my question is there any link between aging and the phenomenon known as brain freeze? As it is something that I've gone my whole life so far being free of, but just now experiencing.
As I said earlier in the show, every day your body shifts 40,000 litres of water across membranes, and the atoms of calcium in your bones are replaced every 10 years, roughly. So you still have the same shape, but you're being rebuilt. You are continually being rebuilt, and something, and this is where I get to the fuzzy bit, something has been rebuilt in the nerves so that now you get brain freeze. We don't fully understand brain freeze. In most people, it happens in the forehead, but some people get it between their shoulder blades, which proves that we don't know what's going on. And so all I can say is something really vague, like you're getting older at the rate of 1 second per second. Things have been rebuilt. They've been rebuilt slightly differently in the nervous system, and now you got it. And I haven't got a better explanation than that. I'm sorry.
No, that's great. So I guess your advice is I should have stuck with my previous makeup and not rebuilt myself.
It's hard because your body rebuilds the cells roughly between once every day and a half to never. Most of the nerve cells are never rebuilt, but we used to believe that. Now we realize we're wrong. And you actually have stem cells. The trouble with brain freeze is it's not a disease that kills people, so there's not much. That much research into it.
But yeah, go back, Patrick, go back.
Yeah. Or eat your ice cream you, more slowly. That's really boring, isn't it?
It is boring. All right.
Sorry.
We're doing Science with Dr. Carl, and we're a couple of days away from Valentine's Day. So, Dr. Carl, are you happy to answer some kind of lovey-dovey, sexy-rexy questions?
Lay it on me, even though... There's not that much science there, but lay it on me.
All right. We've got Pierre in Queensland. Now, Dr. Pierre, I'm going to give a bit of a content warning for your question, but what is it?
My question is, there is a French saying that says there is as much energy in a ejaculation as a pork chop. Is that true?
Pierre, no. It's so good when you say it as well in that French accent.
Thank
if we said it, it probably there's as much ejaculation in a pork chop as, you know. What's the deal, Dr. Carl? Is it true?
200 or 300 calories in a pork chop, maybe one calorie to have an ejaculation, unless you're incredibly athletic.
Do you know where the saying came from, Pierre?
I wouldn't go down that track too far. I don't think it's appropriate.
So have you heard this before, Dr. Carl?
I've heard people say that it ages you or makes you younger. There's a whole lot of things going on with sexual orgasm. I don't know.
Okay. We don't know, Pierre, but, sorry. You know, I think it's a good
saying
when you say it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah. We got Taman in Mianj in Brisbane. Taman, you got a question about aphrodisiacs.
Hey, Doc. This is a question about chocolate. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, since chocolate used to be an aphrodisiac, like, back in the past, why is it not now? Have we become desensitized to it, or... Is it just not as potent as it was?
It was marketing. So one of the best marketing statements ever was just three words, diamonds are forever. And so suddenly they managed to get people to pay huge amounts of money for these essentially worthless bits of stuff. And chocolate, red wine, I'm sorry, it's all marketing. The truth comes, as always, from rock and roll. Frank Zappa. The only real aphrodisiac is your brain. Your main sexual organ is your brain. If your brain finds it sexy, it is sexy. And then you can go off into all of the subsets of sexual activity and people with their various fetishes. So chocolate was advertised as being an aphrodisiac. It wasn't. Red wine was advertised as making you younger because of the chemical called resveratrol. No, it doesn't. I'm sorry. This is hard to say, but they lied to you.
It's all lies.
It's all lies. I'm sorry.
So what about oysters when people say that's an aphrodisiac?
The occasion.
Okay.
The being there. And I want this to be aphrodisiac? Sure. I mean, some people find shoes aphrodisiac. I'm fine with that. If you're not harming somebody and it's all consensual and you're having a good time, hooray.
That's good stuff. Hey, Taman, thanks for your question.
Sorry.
That's all right.
That's all right. That's all right.
They gave me.
And we're a couple of days out from Valentine's Day, so I've been asking you if you've got a, I don't know, maybe a love, relationship, sexy question for Dr. Carl. Send it in. Jacinta in Queensland. Jacinta, what do you want to know?
Hi, I want to know what exactly is cuteness aggression?
That feeling when you see something cute and you just want to scream it.
It actually goes back to 2015, the actual phrase. Mm-hmm. And Oriana, what was the name? Hang on. Aragon. Yeah, I looked it up here on Wikipedia. She wrote about it and she said it's, she called it playful aggression or mm-hmm. cuteness aggression. And it's the expression that people show sometimes when interacting with babies. So sometimes we'll grit their teeth and they clench their hands and pinch their cheeks or say things like, I want to eat you up. Mm. And it seems to be a combination of we are wired up to protect the next generation by showing them love. And sometimes you're so wired up, you express it more than you can usefully do right then. So there is no tiger attacking you, so you don't need to pick them up and run away or kill the tiger. So instead you just squeeze them and it's a overwhelming, I love you and I will protect you no matter what, and express too much.
Mm.
But they don't have a good explanation, but it is real. And they've, Oriana Aragon, then we're looking at a whole bunch of cultures in her later papers and found it as common, not just in English-speaking or European, but right across the whole world. All cultures seem to have this, I want to squeeze you so much because I love you and I want to protect you. But if I squeeze you as hard as I can, I could hurt you. But so I won't do it, but I'll keep that in the background.
That's it's complicated. Yeah, so you know when to stop.
You have to know when to stop.
Jacinta, does that help?
It does. That makes so much sense. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Actually, go to Wikipedia and then look for cuteness aggression and or playful aggression. Then look at the references. And if you read her papers, they come up with about 15 different theories, none of which I understand.
Oh, okay. We've got Linda in Sydney. Dr. Linda, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. My question is, I heard that pigs have orgasms that last for half an hour. Is this true?
Lions are the ones who want to keep on having sex over and over and over again. Pigs, it's not proven in the peer-reviewed literature. So, no, I'm sorry.
Okay, so that's a fib. Thank God for that.
Thank God.
The next question, are dolphins the only mammals besides humans that have sex for pleasure?
I'm kind of doubting that. So for a long time, we humans interacted with animals on a one-to-one basis, and then we went into a scientific-y thing around 1850 to 2000 where we tried to understand it the wrong way and we tried to make it reductionist, in other words, break it down into individual causes. And so for a while there was the belief that all animals just run on reflexes. I'm hungry, so I'll eat. I'm tired, so I'll go to sleep. And, of course, anybody who works with animals knows that that's not true. So we know for sure that dolphins, which literally means a fish with a womb, do have sex for fun, but they're also quite aggressive. And sometimes the males pick on the females. And I don't know of any other specific animals that have it for fun, but almost certainly they will have. Like when you're playing with a dog, you pick up the ball, you throw it away, and it brings it back and does it over and over again. I'm sure the dogs would have sex for fun if they were allowed to, and in those cases run by the females.
So fair enough.
The answer is a definite maybe, and what we need is an evolutionary biologist who would know the answer. Please ring in.
Yeah.
Zoe Keane.
Zoe Keane.
Thank you so much.
Where are you, Zoe?
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you. Bye.
We've got Robert in Queensland. Dr. Robert.
Dr. Robert, welcome.
Change of pace. You got a question about gravity.
I do. Hi, Doctor. My question is about gravity and more about the unification of physics and the effort scientists are going to achieve this. So, as I understand, gravity is just the space-time, the curvature of space-time, and the force that it exerts is more of an illusion than real. But when going into unification of the grand theory, it's put in with the other fundamental forces, and I don't know why we're putting so much effort into trying to find the graviton, which is the,
I'm going to be so honest, Robert's question then was like another language. Dr. Carl, can you kind of break it down for us?
When the physicists look at the world around us, they'll see that practically everything that happens is explained by the electromagnetic force. So my feet are mostly empty space. The floor is mostly empty space. The atoms are a long way away from each other. And the reason I don't fall through the floor is the electromagnetic force. The electrons around each atom are negative and they repel the electrons in the floor. So the electromagnetic force affects practically everything around us. The gravity force, as you suggested, is in fact the curvature of space, and it's quite real, and that's quite a different force. And then there's the strong nuclear force, which holds the positively charged protons in the nucleus together. And then there's the weak nuclear force. And recently, the scientists were able to mathematically join the electromagnetic and the weak nuclear force. They haven't been able to do it with the gravity force. Why do they want to? So that we can then manipulate gravity and understand it. We didn't understand the electromagnetic force, and now you can talk to somebody on the other side of the planet and see their face at the same time. And with gravity, all it does is suck. It doesn't repel. And would it be possible to negate gravity and be able to get to space without rockets? So that's kind of hidden way in the background of Robert, why they want to find out more about gravity. It might have a use further down the line, but as Richard Feynman says, science is like sex. It might have useful outcomes, but that's not why we do it. So the scientists are doing it for fun, and there will be something useful one day.
Okay, so it's worth trying to unify it.
It is definitely worth trying to unify it. You don't know what science will give you.
All right. We've got Archie and Enmore here. Archie, you got a question about microplastics.
Good morning, Dr. Lucy, Dr. Carl.
Welcome.
I have a question. If anyone avoids eating microplastics, will they flush out of your body?
Yes and no. There's a really good podcast on that. Science versus Wendy Zukerman, who used to be here at the ABC, and she's done one on microplastics, and she pointed out that firstly we didn't know they existed, and then we found out they existed, and then we thought that we probably had 7 grams of microplastics in our brain, which is a lot. That's the weight of 6 of those little bottle caps on the water bottles. But now we're thinking it's less than that, and there's an article in the New Scientist just last weekend about how high fiber diets in some cases can grab the microplastics while they're in your gut and take it out. And then we're also looking at ways to actually take them out of your body once they're in there. We're not too sure. They do the hormone scientists called the endocrinologists call them hormone mimickers and claim that they can have hormonal effects. We're still in the early days of that, but there seems to be some degree of truth in it. So chase up New Scientist, microplastics and fiber, and that'll take you down a little wormhole.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Archie. Another place you can go and have a look, Triple J Hack have actually put out an interview today with a young Cronulla counsellor named Cal Glanzig, who actually had his urine tested for microplastics, and he's put the findings and his results basically in a documentary called The Plastic Country, and he reckons it's something that we can get on top of. But if you want to kind of get an insight into just how much microplastics are in our system, apparently the results left him speechless. So
it's available on the Triple J website.
Yeah, Triple J website. The Triple J app as well. So interview why Cal tested his piss for plastic. So you can check that out right now. I'm interested to listen to that. You can do it right now via the Triple J Hack podcast. Imi in Glebe, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. My question is, what is the science behind why there is so much more mould in older houses?
Mould is everywhere. The fungi, that family, they're everywhere in the universe. We've just discovered recently in the last 2 weeks that overwhelmingly around the world, many museums have been contaminated with a white mould that's almost invisible, and you have to use special techniques to find it. And the only way that you know that it's happening is when you get the whiteness on something dark. Mm. So with older houses, the mould spreads everywhere. And if you do not simply remove the old paint and everything in the house, then you're stuck with the mould being there from the past. And it just needs the right environment. Perhaps humans breathing out water vapour and closed doors, and the humidity increases, and then the mould can then start increasing in large numbers. Some people claim that the mould is always death-causing. No, but you definitely don't want it, because I do have a friend who got mould in her lungs and we couldn't get a lung transplant and she died.
Mm.
There you are. That was cheerful. So it's everywhere.
Sorry to laugh.
Sorry,
Dr. It's mainly just you. So the PSAs.
PSAing. Yeah. So get rid of it. So and in older houses, they've been there for 500 years. Okay. 50 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's more time than 5 years. So the mold's had a longer time to get in there. Sorry, Yinnie. Is that bad news for you?
No, that's great. Thank you so much. I will get on to removing the mold ASAP.
Thanks, Imi. And if you're in a rental, get on to your landlord about removing it, honestly, especially if it's not something. If it's a structural thing, yeah. Tia in DY, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. My question is, why do some people get so hot in their sleep?
It happens to me when I've had a really good night with friends and I've eaten too much. And I'll suddenly wake up and I am just radiating heat like crazy. And it may well be the middle of winter. And I think what I'm doing is decoupling of oxidative phosphorylation. Very fancy phrase I haven't used for a while. So what your body does is turn sugar into energy and stores it as fat, and you can go down a pathway where you start generating, instead of storing the energy as fat, you then turn into heat. And I think that's what's happening in my body. I've spoken to a few biochemists, is that I'm doing that, turning the excess sugar floating around in my bloodstream into heat. Does this happen, is it related to having big meals?
I don't know, just my partner always is like radiating an insane amount of heat in bed, and like before we fall asleep completely normal, as soon as she's asleep, like I can feel it when I'm not actually even touching her, like it's just coming off her. But she's not sweaty or anything, she's just radiating so much heat.
Okay, so ignore decoupling of oxidative phosphorylation and eating too much and go to part two, which is that in general, on average, women have cold hands and a warm heart. In general, on average, women have a slightly lower body temperature than men, the colder hands, but they're more emotional. That's really sexist. Boo the patriarchy. Ignore I said it. But in this case, your partner may be one of the people who is not average, you know, because we're not all average. And so I haven't got a good reason why they do that. Maybe the thermometer has said, have you got a little thermometer to measure their body temperature with?
I don't, but maybe I'll go out and buy one.
It's a handy thing to have. So when my wife and I were getting influenza A, I measured 39.5 in her ear, which is just astonishingly high. So here's your way, Peter, to get yourself a Triple J fun pack. Very quietly, while she's having this little heating episode, sneak that little thermometer in her ear and measure the temperature during the night and write it down, right? And you could get a fun pack, okay? So if you do that and if you relate it, you'll get, and you've written it down, you get a fun pack. Okay, Peter, that's your homework.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Carl.
Good luck. We've got Cam in Perth. Cam, you've got a question about noise-cancelling headphones. Bit of a debate with this one.
There is, mate. Yeah, good morning, doctors.
Good morning.
The noise-cancelling headphones, do they protect your ears from external, like, sources?
I think they do, but I'm not 100% sure. So what happens is, imagine you've got a wave in the ocean and it goes up and down and up and down, and then imagine that a ship, say, falls in the water and generates a wave which is upside down, where there's a valley, the wave is a hill. And where there's a hill, there's a valley. And so you add a hill and a valley together, you get flatness. And so in the noise-cancelling headphones, what they have is a microphone. And it analyzes the sound coming in and then turns it upside down. And there's a little loudspeaker inside that generates an upside-down waveform. And the hills kiss the valleys and it all goes flat. The question is this. Is the eardrum vibrating more than normal or less than normal? If it's vibrating less than normal, you're not having hearing damage. I'm guessing that's the case, but I'd really need to speak to an audiologist on that. And luckily I'm seeing my ear, nose and throat doctor next week, so I'll just check that out. So Cam, I'll try and get an answer for you. I think that they reduce the damage. On the other hand, there is a problem where we've found with many people in their early teens, they're suffering the problem of people in their 60s where they cannot pick up a voice at a crowded party.
Oh.
And so what we've had is people wearing noise reduction earphones, headphones, or either the little plug things in your ears, the earbuds, and they've been wearing them from say when they were 9 to when they were 12, and your brain is always learning, and during that period, when you're between 8 and 12, your brain at rest uses up 50% of your energy. So we've found this population of people aged 12 who have not trained their brain to pick up a single voice from a noisy background.
Wow.
And they haven't learned how to do it, and they can't do it because they wore the noise reduction headphones all the time.
Oh, God.
They wore the noise-cancelling headphones all the time, and they didn't learn. Their brain wasn't learning that skill.
Damn. Well, we'll find out from the audiologist, Cam.
Yeah.
Check in next week, I reckon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cam.
And wrapping us up, we've got Pippa, the Southern Highlands Pippa.
Dr. Pippa, welcome.
What's your question?
Hi, doctors. So my husband kisses me on one side of my cheek or my neck, and my whole whatever side it is, of my body gets covered in goosebumps.
Wow.
And I was wondering why.
Yeah. Because you're lucky.
And it's happened with no one else ever before.
Hang on, wait a sec. But have you tried it with somebody else after? That's a very impertinent question, isn't it?
Not after, no. I do have kids, and, like, they give me little kisses on my cheeks or my necks, and, like, I'm not ticklish or anything, but, yeah, it's just very specifically with him, and they're really, really strong goosebumps.
Okay, so... And the goosebumps are on one side of your body only?
Yes, just whichever side that kiss has been on.
So it's not contralateral. So if you get the kiss on the right side of the cheek, it's on the right cheek, it's on the right side of the body?
Yes, correct.
Oh, my God. There's so much going on. Here's my answer. Number one, you're lucky. Number two, almost certainly you have a little bit of cross-wiring, which is why some people... when they go into bright sunlight, will sneeze. Thirdly, almost certainly there's some degree of conditioning, which is lucky again, in that your children, when doing roughly the same action, don't set off the same reaction. But what leaves me a little bit astonished is the fact that it's not contralateral. It doesn't happen on the other side of your body. And normally there's a crossover between at your neck, between your head and the body. I have got to chase this one up. Wow.
You've got a little bit of homework this week, Dr. Carl.
You're a lucky person, Dr. Pippa. I'm so impressed. Wowee. Wow. Oh, that's
Thank you.
And it still happens after you've got kids and everything.
True love.
True love. We need more love songs.
Thanks, Pippa.
Thank you, Dr. Pippa.
Thank you.
We'll do this again next week, Carl.
Ever so pretty keen, indeedy.
I can't wait. And that's it. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Science with Dr. Carl, which honestly felt like a choose-your-own-adventure. If there was a topic that stuck out to you that reminded you of a friend or a conversation you had with someone recently, I want you to send this podcast episode to them. Make sure you're subscribed so you know when the next episode drops. I'm Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Jazz Williams, and we'll catch you next week. Oh, and happy Valentine's Day. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast, it's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.